You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast focused on the modern format. Each week, we go deep on brewing spicy new decks geared at tournament play. We put our creations to the test in Magic Online leagues and share our findings on the air. If you would like to support Faithless Brewing, we would love to hear your feedback. You can leave us a review on iTunes, tell a friend, and follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to week 7 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am joined, as always, on the West Coast by Damon Alexander. Damon, how's it going, buddy?
It's good. I got knocked out on the top 4 of this month's calendar tournament, but otherwise, having fun, enjoyed playing some new lists. How are you doing, Dave?
Pretty good. You know, it's like the Eagles always say, it's windy at the top. Sometimes you get blown off the summit.
Yeah.
Can't stay up there forever. Also joining us is Daniel Schriever. He is Cave Dan Online, and he is the primary tweeter at, what's the Twitter handle, Dan?
Wait, what's our Twitter handle?
Our Twitter handle.
You are the tweeter.
You make manifest.
Faithless MTG, buddy.
Faithless MTG.
I'm doing well, David. Good to see you all.
Excellent. So we got East Coast and we got West Coast. We're bringing the two factions together.
Coast to coast brews. I like it.
So we have a busy week this week. We're going to go over some of our results from our Bolus of Citadel testing. We've got Modern Horizons is out. There are a bunch of lists that have become super prevalent online. We'll talk about maybe ways to attack those. And then we have a couple cards we're going to start discussing this week and the next couple weeks that will maybe help attack the new metagame. So to start us off, let's just kind of quickly recap. Last week, Dan tried to sell Damon and myself on Bolus of Citadel. You had, what would you say, Dan, 5 or 6 sort of loose shells, you know, kind of different ways you could get this 6-mana artifact in play to attack the metagame. And I know you got a ton of results, so do you want to kind of just start us off?
Gosh, I feel like a used car salesman. Like, I got this rusty, beat-up Yawgmoth bargain. Like, she still runs.
She only drove it to church every Sunday.
She's a good engine.
Yeah, they say that Insanity is trying the same thing over and over again when expecting different results, which is actually not fair because the vending machine, it works. Sometimes you try it and then you try it again and it works. But I feel like Dan's attempts were he went deep on Citadel. But let me start off with my one run.
I object to that characterization.
We were trying different things each time.
I tried different lists every time, which I can't say the same for some other people who were, some streamers were streaming the same thing and just getting farmed over and over again. I was at least trying to learn from my mistakes and like changing my approach. But yes, continue, Damon. Sorry.
Okay, so I played a league with a black-red Citadel list. This was a list that featured mostly some of the Lantern cards and the Mill Rocks, and then 4 Goblin Engineer, and then the plan was to try to entomb, or I guess the new word is Goblin Engineer, your Citadel into the graveyard, and then use Trash for Treasure on a Mox Opal or a Darksteel Citadel or one of your Mill Rocks to bring the Citadel back into play, and then from there the win is elementary. Well, not quite elementary. And so I played a league and I went a grand total of 1-4, which wasn't the best result in the world, as you can see. But it was interesting. So the first round was against Infect. It turns out Infect is A, fast, and B, a little disruptive. In this deck's Goldfish is maybe turn 4 or turn 5, and Infect's Goldfish is maybe turn 2 or 3. It was featuring the new Scale Up card, and we got scaled up, so we lost that one. Playing us Blue-Red Living End, that was a sweet, sweet match. I have to say that the Citadel plan, when it works, is just maniacal. It's just so much fun. I mean, you do all this stuff, and then eventually get this Aether Swarm Reservoir into play, and you can do even more stuff. So what happens is you get the Citadel into play, and then you want to keep casting cards. That's the whole point of Citadel. And then ultimately find an Aether Flux Reservoir, and then use all the spells you've cast to gain at least 50 life, and then pop your opponent for 50. And so the key blocker for this in terms of deck building is if you hit a bunch of lands in a row, you can't keep playing them off of the Citadel. So you need a plan to get the lands away. And so that's what the mill rocks were for. If you tap a Codex Shredder on yourself with the Citadel and play the land on top, you no longer have a land on top, and hopefully you hit another card. And if, as long as you have a critical mass of mill rocks, you'll actually just go infinite. And then you eventually find the reservoir, hopefully with a Goblin Engineer, you put in your graveyard, then you find a Trash for Treasure and play it. And the deck, once it was able to do this, was just, first off, it was just a blast. And second off, it was a win. And we got some interesting wins against almost every match. We managed to at least win one game.
Yes, it was a win, singular win, a match win out of the five, and a game win out of three. So,
we were at, but we'll take it. Clean sweep, 2-0. It turns out their clock was like the same speed as our clock. We had a little bit of discard for their Electro Dominance, Living End Plan, and Ensnaring Bridge actually just sort of shuts them down to begin with. But it was a tricky match. We had to fight through some cryptic commands. The deck actually felt pretty good, but that's not a tier one opposition. We played against blue-white, and we could have actually won the match. We actually had a critical window where we cast a couple spells. They all got countered. And we cast a Citadel, and it got Snap. Dovin's vetoed. And after the match, I was like, oh, yeah. Noxious Revival can actually like put their Dovin's veto on top of their library in response to the trigger, and then they can't use it. And then that would have let us resolve a Citadel and almost certainly win. And so we lost the game as a result. And so actually that match could have been winnable. It turns out that blue-white control, even though it feels like it should be really bad, was a little bit better of a matchup than I thought going in. And we won another game where we just kind of kept casting discard spells and Citadels, and eventually they ran out of stuff. And then game three, they had both Rest in Peace and Stony Silence, and that was difficult to deal with. I think that those two cards together may actually just be a KO to this deck's plan. It's really hard to work through both, unless you have maybe a Blast Zone would have gotten us out of it. Blue-green turns, that was a tough matchup. Our Goldfish was maybe about the same speed as theirs, but they just happened to win in that round. And then Tron just kind of Tron'd us. In the second game, we had a chance to win. They played a Karn, and they exiled the wrong card. And so we were able to cast a Citadel, but one of the first cards we hit was a Citadel. And the deck takes some practice that I think we hadn't had at that point. Maybe Dan's become the expert of this now, and that's that if you have some mill rocks in play and a card you don't really want to pay the life for on top, do you mill it? Because if you use your mill rock aggressively and you hit a land clump, now you're stuck. And so if you just cast a Citadel, you just lose six life, but you keep an extra mill rock. And ultimately, I ran out of life, and so I had to stop the engine going, and then I lost. But maybe if I'd been smarter with that mill, I would have had a chance to actually get a turn for kill on Tron. It felt interesting. It felt sometimes you could kind of dirtle for the first end turns. Goblin Engineer felt good with the Lotus Bloom plan, but not quite great. If you have like a one drop artifact and you drop the Engineer on turn two and go put a Lotus Bloom in the graveyard, on turn three you only get to 5 mana because the Goblin Engineer takes a mana to activate. Not the 6 mana you need for the Citadel. So it's like almost capable of getting a turn 3 Citadel into play by itself, but it isn't quite there, which I found a little disappointing.
Compare that to something like Reshape, which is also a 2 mana play you can make to get the Lotus Bloom, which actually does get you to 6 on the next turn. So yeah, the curve is slightly off with the Engineer, which is a little disappointing, but yeah, maybe exactly. It's better for the best. I don't know.
Yeah, so Dan, I know you tried not just one list, not just two lists, but many lists. I saw you play a league with a black-green, kind of aristocrats list. You want to walk us through how you were doing with it?
Let me hold off on the aristocrats list for a second. I wanted to say a little more about the Lantern archetype. Yeah. So I tried a couple different variants on the basic shell that Damon was describing. And I think the biggest difference in the ones that I was trying was that, well, you heard Damon talk about his Goldfish turn in various matchups. And I think that was because his build was playing a full set of 4 Citadel, full set of Trash for Treasure, 4 Goblin Engineers, is that right? And Lotus Blooms, yeah. So 3 or 4.
And it literally could not win without the Citadel plan.
Yeah. And all in plan, as we would say.
Right. So I think there we were trying to just like learn, you know, what is the Goldfish turn and is that going to hold up? But the Miller Rocks were not really capable of locking down a game. So I tried 2 variants that were actually more of a control plan that actually didn't play 4 Citadels. In one version, I was on red-black with the 4 Engineers, but just the 1 Citadel, which the Engineers would find. And then this gave me space in the deck to play Inquisitions, Thought Seizes, elements of discard that you'll find in more traditional Lantern. And I played another league where I actually just took a stock Bug Lantern deck, like, you know, the ones that used to be like a scourge of the format, and I changed like 6 cards. I added 1 Citadel, 3 Lotus Bloom, and 2 Karn. Like, actually, that was the very first one that I played. I just wanted to get a feel for, like, how Lantern plays and, like, is the Sigil useful in that plan when it's in play. So just briefly, with the stock Lantern plus Citadel, I think I went 0-5. That was interesting because I was thinking, like, I was hoping to get some close games, but mostly I just, like, left that league thinking, like, how does Lantern ever win these matchups? Like, are these just bad matchups? But I'm getting crushed, and I thought, like, maybe there would be, like, hard decisions about, like, what do I do here? Like, maybe one play wins, one play loses, but it wasn't like that. It was more like, is there any play I can make that will prevent me from dying on turn three to, like, this red Phoenix deck or this Infect deck? Or is it Phoenix? I played against Tron one round, and it was like, well, I have to, like, okay, finally, there's a Sylvan Scrying on top. Like, I can leave that, but, like, oh, no, I can't because they have Blast Zone now, which will ruin. It was a nightmare league. The red-black version that was very close to the one Damon was describing actually did much better. That one, I went 2-3. And the losses were pretty close. They were all to counterspell heavy decks. I lost two matches to blue white. Those went to three games, and one against an As Foretold deck that had a lot of counterspells, and beat a couple of combo decks. So, like, in that deck, I was encouraged by the fact that, like, I was able to disrupt them. And when, like, the going got tough with counterspells, like, I was able to sideboard out of the Citadel combo finish and just, like, side in more of a Pithing Needle Lantern control package. But 2-3 is not great, and like Damon was saying, like, these decks have plenty of Stony Silence type cards. You expect to face those. They will have them. You have to either mill them away or discard them. So I think of those three sort of Lantern lists that we tried, probably the best direction would be the one that only plays maybe a single Citadel, or maybe more. But I don't think, like, the all-in plan is fast enough.
I do think the other factor that you're saying here, Dan, is beyond whether Bolas the Citadel is a good card or not, it might just be that the format is just not a welcoming place for these sort of Lantern lists. We have multiple new graveyard hate pieces printed in the new set, plus Karn from the last set. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways to just kind of lock out the mill plan that can even be main deck in some cases.
Yeah, and it's not just Karn even, it's the Collector Oof from Modern Horizons, which is a Stony Silence on a creature. So if you're keeping track, then if you're on a Lantern-style deck, you now have to expect that they will have either an enchantment that locks you out, a creature that locks you out, or a Planeswalker that locks you out. And these are all, like, widely played cards in Modern right now.
Yeah, and they expressly are cards that you can't destroy with your preferred plan of Engineered Explosives because they don't let you activate the explosive. So you have to do it with some other effect.
There was a Reddit thread, somebody asked, did Affinity get anything cool with Modern Horizons? And one person was like, actually, all I got was new hate cards. so I think that's
they basically signal, we're not going to ban Mox Opal, but we are going to give basically every color a tool. And then there's a one in a red dredge shatter effect as well. So that tells me they don't want to ban Mox Opal, but they don't want to make it easy on the artifact lovers out there.
So three leagues of that kind of artifact heavy build was enough for me to, like, move off of that direction. But if you recall in our conversation last week when I was trying to talk to you about Citadel, I was saying we should just ignore the last line of text, the tap, sacrifice 10 other permanents to deal 10 damage. I was thinking, like, all I'm really interested in is the card draw engine and the mana engine, which can be used to support some other kind of win. So what I explored next were decks that had the ability to win with a Citadel in play, but, like, otherwise were still functional decks. And the engine that kind of began to intrigue me as I was thinking about it more was an Aristocrat Shell, because the card Viscera Seer, which is a, you know, one black vampire that lets you sacrifice a creature to scry one, can, for no mana, can change the top of your deck repeatedly. And it's, if you have something like a Blood Artist in play, that will get you some life back so that you have mana, or you have life to, like, keep casting cards. So, like, if you have a Viscera Seer plus a Blood Artist in play, and most of your deck is creatures, like, let's say mana creatures that help you ramp into the Citadel in the first place, you can go off that turn. And the rest of your deck will look just sort of like a creature deck that has the Citadel sitting at the top of the curve. So where I started with that was in a black-green space. The first deck I tried was actually inspired by a Cryptolith Rites deck that I used to play in Standard, which is maybe a sign that I'm not shooting high enough with my with my ability. I had a full set of blister pod, which I know Luis Scott Vargas was rocking in the top eight of a standard PT some years ago. Ended up not playing the Cryptolith rights. I played Collected Company instead. The build was like a little bit half-baked. I was able to go off a couple times, but I had trouble like actually lining up the Citadel with the games where I had six mana and vice versa. Because I didn't actually have a way to search for the Citadel. I was just like hoping to draw it naturally. So I think that first take had the wrong creature support. Like I had Carrion Features there as an additional sacrifice outlet, but I didn't have anything to like make them huge or aggressive. So they just like weren't getting it done. I thought there was still something there that was like worth one more league. So I updated it significantly to be more like green white Collected Company deck, where I wanted to curve mana creature, like actual mana creatures like Birds of Paradise, Noble Hierarchs, into 3-drop. So the 3-drop that intrigued me was Ranger Captain of Eos, which can search up a 1-drop like a Viscera Seer to like get the piece I need to keep going. And then like, you know, other 3-drops, like Catacomb Sifter was one that was in and out of my list because he can help you scry. So I tried like a version of that that had actually both the Ranger Captain of Eos and the original Ranger of Eos to like search up a bunch of these 1-mana creatures. I had a bunch of 0-mana creatures as well. I had Hangarback Walkers and Walking Ballistas, and that deck did okay. It was a creature deck. Like they're okay. Like they weren't anything special, and I was having trouble like again getting the Citadel in play in a timely fashion. So I'm kind of off those. I think that if I were to revisit them, like that was actually the most consistent kill engine. The Viscera Seer plus Blood Artist engine was smoother than the Lantern engine. Like I rarely fizzled. I did sometimes run out of life if I didn't find the Blood Artist in time, so I had to like pause for a turn and then they have a chance to like wrath me or something like that. But it was like an okay deck. But I think the main weakness there was finding the Citadel on time. Also just like the creature-based strategy is a little underpowered right now. That led me finally to... So I'll just call it like, how does the Mardu Helix build? So my thought process here was I was thinking back to Niv-Mizzet Reborn, which, you know, we struggle with like how to ramp that into play and still have a functional deck, like if you're filling your deck with ramp cards. And it turned out that the most successful build was one that didn't really bother trying to ramp. It was just sort of sat back, settled in for a slower control game, then just like eventually cast their big finisher. And I was thinking like, okay, if I think of Citadel that way as like a card that like I don't need to turbo into play, like I just need a game plan that, you know, will eventually arrive at six mana and then I land my Citadel and suddenly win with it. Where would that take me? And I started just putting a bunch of Lightning Helix style cards in the decks, which, you know, those are mana neutral if you're thinking of your life in terms of mana. You can play 4 Lightning Helix, you can play some Collective Brutalities, those cost 2 and drain 2. And now you can play 4 Smiting Helix. Smiting Helix is 3 and a black for a sorcery speed Lightning Helix that flashes back for red and a white. I see you nodding, Dave. You were high on this card. I think you were tipping me off that it might be worth looking at.
Yeah, so you kind of outlined what you were hoping to have in this deck, and I think you and I kind of threw a list together that you ran through a league. You know, obviously still trying to decide what we want to do with the 4-mana Planeswalker slot. You know, I really like Nahiri. We were at first maybe even considering having a little refurbished package in there for the Bolas of Citadel, but I think we kind of moved away from that to be as being a main theme of the deck.
Yeah, I think that what we got right about that was using a modest number of Citadels. So I think we had like maybe 2 copies.
I think 2 is the number.
Yeah, and I was thinking, well, if there's only 2 of those, like I don't think I want to play a refurbished. That's the only artifact in the deck. So instead, I did play 1 Obsidat's Aid. It was actually pretty good. That card has not seen play since I don't even know when.
I have never saw play. So
the thing is, I had a variety of permanents that I wanted to return to play. I had various Planeswalkers. I had, you know, a mishmash of ragtag crew of Mardu Planeswalkers. I had a Johnny Vengeant. I had Chandra Torch of Defiance. I had Nahiri the Harbinger, Liliana. Ended up winning a match with Obsidat's Aid returning Stony Silence that was destroyed randomly. So it was like pretty good, like the singleton Obsidat's Aid. But, yeah, so that deck actually felt okay. Like the curve was a little off. Collective Brutality was not quite as good as I hoped. But the Smiting Helix just turns out to like, it's worth a good amount. I know it looks kind of slow and ponderous. At least that's what I thought when Dave was trying to nudge me toward the card, but it's actually quite good.
Did you play the full 4?
I played a full set of Forest Mighting Helix. I had Forest Mighting Helix, which is worth, they're each worth 6 damage, right? So that's 24 damage just from that card alone, plus the Lightning Helix is a set of those, plus the Brutalia. I could deal so much direct damage to them. And it actually worked pretty well. I think I went 4-1 in the league, and I ground out a couple of other control decks. I beat this Hogak Vine deck. I lost once to that deck as well, but the it felt like I was playing like a pretty reasonably well-conceived control deck that like happened to make great use of the Citadel when it drew it, but also still functioned without it, which I think is kind of like where I wanted to be. So after that successful or moderately successful run, or I'll call it an encouraging run, the 4-1 run with that.
Sure. Not discouraging, no, like the rest of these leagues.
encouraging.
Yes.
I don't know, a moment of madness, I was like, well, what if I always had the Citadel in play? Like, I don't just want to draw it some of the time. It's so good with these Helixes. Like, I really want it in play. So let's throw some Madcap Experiments into the deck. Madcap Experiment, as Damon was telling us last week, actually does damage to you. So you need some way to prevent that. At first, I was interested in Burrent and Forge Tender. You can use to prevent all damage from your Madcap Experiment, but that card just like didn't quite do enough on its own. So instead, I ended up on Soulfire Grandmaster to give my own Madcap Experiment lifelink, and then to have a few more copies, I went with Ruined Halo, which is kind of an embarrassing play. I never ended up making this play. You know, you draw your Ruined Halo, you have to like cast it and name Madcap Experiment. And at that point, I think your opponent just sort of screenshots you and like posts and snickers to their friends, like, get a load of this guy. What an idiot. The theory was that like if I had to, I could do that, but that Ruined Halo was still like a okay card. And the rest of the shell was like similar. And this deck really just straight up sucked. Like, this was one of the worst decks I tried. I did win a match, but I think the main problem was that like the Madcap package just eats up so many slots that when it came time to sideboard, which is where as a control deck you're making a lot of your meal money there, I just like didn't have the right number of slots available to like put in the relevant cards, and I wasn't getting that much. Like even the games where it would have been great to draw the Madcap Experiment now, like I only had 4 copies, so like it's not like I was guaranteed to have it at the right time. So don't do that. Do not play Madcap Experiment.
Not for this card. The normal Madcap Experiment is literally just 5 cards. The thing you're proposing involves like 14 cards, so that's a little different package.
But yeah, it made Madcap Experiment into like a 2-piece combo, although twice I had to just sort of cast it blind. I just had to believe. Like, I'm at 20 life and they've landed a Jace. I have not for. Let's just cast a blind experiment. Like, as the card was intended to be cast. Like, you just fire it off and hope for the best. And I think I took 17 damage or something. But I lived.
Did you win?
I did not win.
Find 4 Lightning Helixes off the top and regain that life?
I cast like 3 spells or something like that, but then they just played a Teferi and tucked it, and then it was over. So so that was the Mardu build. I think the non-Madcap version had something going on. And like the last build that I just want to mention as being promising was the card Shape Anew, which is a polymorph for artifacts, 3 to blue. So that one will get the artifact directly into play without a drawback. Like, you won't take any damage. The drawback is in your deck building. You have to be able to generate artifact tokens in some way. And then, like, let's say you have 4 Shape Anew, you probably need 2 copies of the artifact that you're trying to search for. So if you have 4 Shape Anew, 2 Citadel, you can have, like, some shell that supports that with artifact tokens. So I tried a league with Esper build of that, where my artifact generators were Thraben Inspector, Blade Splicer. Yeah, I couldn't quite come up with additional artifacts beyond that, so I went with with Ranger Captain of Eos to find the Thraben Inspector. That was good. And then I went with some cards that have no text on them, namely Countless Gears Renegade, Dire Reporter, and Hidden Stockpile. Those are blanks, but you know they were okay for me in drafts and sometimes in standards. So I figured, why not? And that deck like was actually okay. It went 2-3, and I think like having actual good cards in the deck, I had some little Teferi, and I was able to side into Restoration Angels when it was time to like move away from the combo. That deck was actually quite effective at getting the Citadel. Like, the Shape Anew was quite clean for that. So I think there's something there like worth exploring. It might not be a Citadel deck, but if you wanted to Shape Anew something into play, like a Blightsteel Colossus or whatever the case may be, we speculated on Shaping Anew for a knowledge pool, something like that. You could try that. So I tried one version of that with Esper, and again, my kill was the Viscera Seer, Cruel Celebrant. engine that we talked about. Those were some of the weaker cards in the deck. And I tried one builds that I actually didn't play, but it looked like something that I would potentially play, Bant build, where they theorized that the best standalone cards that produce artifact tokens are Tireless Tracker, Blaze Placer, and Thraven Inspector. So this would be like a green-white deck that just like splashed the Shape Anew and then also had a Blood Artist and Viscera Seer to like round it out. So I think of the decks that functioned on their own and could still have a sort of explosive finish with the Citadel, the most promising lines were the Mardu Helix heavy builds and then maybe something with Shape Anew. None of these decks merited a second league. So I think after each league, I was like, well, I've learned what I wanted to learn about these builds. And I have some ideas for improving it, but like I didn't feel like compelled to push further on them. You got to take your beatings, learn your lessons. The meta is very hostile right now for much of what Citadel is trying to do. Like, you run into artifact hate, you run into graveyard hate if you're trying to use any kind of reanimation. And just like the blue decks have gotten a ton of tools. I got some Force of Negations cast against me. A lot of Archmage Charms were cast for great value against me. Yeah, all kinds of bad things were happening.
If only there were more gears you could count. For those of you listening to the car who are like, what is this Countless Gears Renegade card? I've played Modern for, you know, 5 years and haven't heard of that yet. Don't even bother looking it up, by the
way. Please don't. Dan would prefer if you did.
Hey, this is why you're listening to this cast, right? You want the freshest tech.
Absolutely. what cards to play and also what cards not to play. All right, those are both important.
How about the Dire Fleet Hoarder? Any Ixalan draft fans here? Like, I can run
for you. That was a 2 out of 5 Ixalan draft card.
In addition to Dan, I did see that a couple other prominent streamers, both Conley Woods and Matt Nass with Sam Pardee, tried other types of shells. They also were inspired by Bolas the Citadel. And I think they were playing what we would call an all-in type of list, right, Dan? They were playing the one in a green storm card that gained 3 life for every spell you cast. So you didn't just have to hit other Flux Reservoir. You could hit that card to kind of keep going. And then they were using sort of one mana artifact cantrips to kind of switch the top of their deck. And then they're playing relatively low land count decks. I don't really remember, maybe 14, 15 land with four Mox Opal and the like Whir of Invention or some of the other blue search for artifact effects. I wasn't very impressed by any of them, and I think in that case, especially, you've got some of the world's best players, especially Matt Nass is a wonderful combo player. They were just getting housed left and right by other decks in the format. So, I mean, do you have any thoughts on that type of a build, Dan or Damon?
I hated those builds.
not enough Countless Gears Renegades to really be considered seriously.
Well, so Conley Woods, bless his heart, a wonderful brewer. Great inspiration, and he had been tweeting about Citadel for a couple of weeks now. I think that was part of why I was like kicking the idea around in my head, seeing some of his lists that he proposed. But like all of his builds, I think every single one of them he's played so far have been like extremely all in on the Citadel, to the point that they're playing cards like Children of Corliss, yeah, Cathedral Sanctifier in one of his decks, Weather the Storm. Weather the Storm gains a lot of life, but it's the same thing. Like you're looking at these cards, they don't do anything relevant for the game except like you hope you combo off with them. So my impression was that like none of those decks that they were playing like even remotely attempted to move out of the glass cannon space. I think that their results reflected that. Like, you know, they won a match or two here. They came close some games, but it didn't feel like they were on the verge of like unlocking something. It felt like they were extremely fragile to every interaction of every kind. So I think if you're going to do something like that, I would recommend the Lantern strategy instead. Like the Mill Rocks are effectively the same as the cantrips. I think they were all playing things like Chromatic Sphere, Chromatic Star to like draw the top card of their deck. But like that only works if you have mana floating. And sometimes they would like run out of mana floating when they were trying to do that. The Mill Rocks don't have that problem. The Mill Rocks actually like remove the land from your deck entirely. So if you have to shuffle up with a fetch land or something, like your deck is not like suddenly full of lands.
Or with Whir of Invention, or with the blue X Sack and Artifact, which also shuffle your deck. Yeah. Or Goblin Engineer if you're in there. I'm just saying the Mill Rock again is more effective because you're taking those lands out of your deck.
Yeah. And then of course, like if you have a Lantern and a Codex Shredder, you can stop them from drawing a card. Even if that's not like how you intend to win the game, like you can at least interact for a little while potentially. So who knows? Maybe
I'm not convinced that the Lantern plan is actually that strong in the sense that there were a lot of times we just had a bunch of Codex Shredders and nothing to shred. Once we tried to mill their Chalice of the Void and then they just cycled the card to draw in response and then the one card really needed to stop, we couldn't. I mean, did you manage to get a good Lantern lock going many of the time, like much of the time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I won a couple matches that way. But I mean, like, your build daemon did not have the full Lantern package.
Yeah.
You were just, I think, using them just to cheaply mill the top card for the most part.
And to have easy sideboard cuts.
Yeah, and the more of them you cut, like the less capable you are of going off. But we never stooped to playing Weather the Storm, I will say that. And
so I think that the primary takeaway that we're saying here is we're not saying anything meta level about is Citadel Bolas playable or not. But the one thing we are saying is if it is going to be playable, the way that you have to build around it to make the deck perfectly linear, glass cannony, you are not fast enough to compete with the other super linear decks of Modern. You're a turn or a half turn or two turns in some cases, maybe slower. So if you want to play with this card, and I hope you guys will correct me if I'm wrong, you have to be doing something else to use it. You can't just dedicate, you know, your 40 non-land slots to putting Citadel of Bolas in play and trying to win. That does not seem to be, whether it's Matt Nass, whether it's the builds we're proposing, those were not yet competitive with the other decks in Modern. Is that a fair statement?
I think that sums it up well.
I think that the results don't lie.
Although you don't want to be too results-oriented, but I, in this case, am going to choose to be very results-oriented. So possible avenues to go forward. Dan, you're saying maybe there's something there with that Mardu list, just as a general control strategy with kind of an oops, I win type of finish at the top. That had some possibilities. And maybe a kind of, I guess you'd call that Bance, but it's really splashing the blue just for shape anew, sort of Aristocrats. Or is that a four-color list?
It is a four-color list, yeah. Right, so I think shape anew, the takeaway I had was that shape anew was the best way to cheat it into play or get it into play ahead of schedule.
Because it requires a lot less of your deck. You just play four shape anews and then creatures that are almost playable or are playable in some cases.
Yeah, so then where you go from there is, that's still up in the air. You need to find like a plausible shell to support it. I think either Esper or Abzan or something like that. Or Bant.
So if some enterprising young kid out there wants to make some moves with Bolas of Citadel, I mean, give us a shout. Give us some ideas. We're open to anything.
I've got some Citadels to sell you.
Yeah, like, I mean,
I have a stack of failed spec Citadels to sell you. So hit me up.
Well, while we were pursuing the Bolas of Citadel plan, Modern Horizons dropped online. I think it was out on Thursday or Friday. Or I went to play on Thursday and the system was down. So I think Friday was the first day you could play with Modern Horizons. And one list in particular kind of captured the imagination of a bunch of people online. I saw Canister, who is a spectacular combo player in Modern, playing it. Damon, do you want to talk a little bit about this Hogak Dredgevine list? I don't know what you want to call it.
Yeah, so this is the deck that has taken Modern by storm. It placed 30% of the most recent Modern challenge of the top 32, and I think 50% of the top 16, and 3 or 4 in the top 8, which is kind of shocking for a deck that has been around for, you know, a number of days. Generally speaking, when a great new deck comes out, it takes, you know, maybe a week or a month or so for the deck to really get solidified as people keep tuning it. You know, Izzet Phoenix wasn't the most busted deck in Modern immediately. It took a lot of refining. And then steadily, maybe a month or two after it started taking off, did it really start to really capture the meta. So the way this deck works, if you aren't familiar with it, is it uses the new card Hogak, which is 5 and then a hybrid black-green mana, and 2 of those hybrid mana, so 7 total. And you cannot cast, use mana for it. It has Convoke and Delve, and then it's an 8-8 Trampler. It slots into a deck that is fundamentally Bridgevine, featuring Vengevines and Citrus Suppliers, and Bloodghasts and Gravecrawlers, and then a new card from Modern, Altar of Dementia, which was also put into Modern Horizons, which lets you sack a creature to mill cards from target player's deck equal to the creature's power. And so the deck can win in a variety of ways. The most combo way is, oh yeah, and Bridge from Below is probably one of the most busted cards in the deck, along with Faithless Looting. And so you use Citrus Supplier to maybe jumpstart your graveyard, and then you can get a Hogak into play pretty easily off of a couple zombies or whatever, and then just a few cards in your graveyard, maybe a Citrus Supplier plus a Fetchland or two will get you there on its own. And then you can sack the Hogak to your altar to mill yourself for 8, and then from there you usually flip over some bridges or maybe, and then maybe some other stuff. maybe some blood ghasts, and then you use the number of new cards to delve the next Hogak into play, or just the same one, along with the zombies you made off Bridge from Below or whatever you have lying around. And then you use this one to mill yourself again, and eventually you start hitting multiple bridges, and now every Hogak sack gets you multiple zombies. And then by the time you reach the end of your deck, you can now recast Hogak a bunch of times, get back all your blood ghasts, and then get a million zombies, sack all the zombies to altar, and mill your opponent out. And this can happen as early as turn two.
And just to be clear to everyone, so because Hogak has Convoke, two zombies, so if you have two Bridge from Below, two zombies in play, plus five cards from your graveyard, cast Hogak, and then he mills you eight again, and then gets you two more zombies. So you go up three cards, even with no extra bridges. So you, the two bridges is what you need to kind of go deterministically infinite, as Damon's describing.
Right, right. And even if you manage to stop the altar plan, your opponent will frequently just somehow manage to get a turn two, you know, they go Citrus Supply or Faithless Looting, they drop some cards in the bin, and then turn two they manage to somehow cast a Hogak and Avenge Vine off the Hogak or something. And so you look at the rest in peace in your hand at this point, and you're like, oh man, I was going to play this turn once I untapped and played a land, but now they have an 8/8 and a 4/3 haste, and I'm at, you know, 16 life. And so then by the time you play the rest in peace, you take 12, and you're just basically dead. And so even their non-graveyard plans or non-altar plans can just dump a bunch of creatures. And so it kind of goes both tall with Hogak being an 8/8 trampler and wide with the bridge plan and blood gas and all that. And then even if you play a Rest in Peace, they'll come prepared game two with Wispmare or Nature's Claim. And so then they'll, even if you manage to kind of slow them down until turn four with Rest in Peace or turn five or whatever, once they Wispmare your Rest in Peace, they just go off. And if you don't, I mean, if your deck is sort of too reliant on graveyard and you miss your, you muddle your main deck to not have an efficient kill against them, you know, Ventvine is just a 4/3 haste for four. It will kill you pretty rapidly if your deck is too busy casting Rest in Pieces and you know, backup Craft Digger's Cages and things like that and not enough actual gas spells. So the deck is exceedingly powerful. If you're going to join a modern league, make sure you come prepared. The best forms of interaction tend to be, probably the single best one is Leyline of the Void, because it comes down turn zero. Rest in Peace is a close second. Craft Digger's Cage is kind of okay, along with Tormod's Crypt and Relic of Progenitus. They frequently, one shot is not enough. You can watch people playing leagues and the opponent plays a Craft Digger's Cage and a Tormod's Crypt and they still just get crushed. And so, and Surgical is just kind of like, you're swatting them. You're swatting a crocodile or something. It just doesn't do anything. It tickles them.
You made it.
They just have to use one of the other angles.
I've seen quite a few people play against it. I mean, it's, you know, I think when the last set came out, or maybe it was two sets ago, there was kind of a Bridge Vine list then that looked like maybe it was going to be the new thing, and it turned out to kind of be a flavor of the month. This list, Dan, seems like it's got a lot more staying power. It even has a new card that Damon didn't even mention, which is Carrion Feeder, which kind of helps support the Vengevine plan. It can recast Gravecrawler, for instance, just that and two black mana, recast your Vengevines. You don't need any other cards. So yeah, it's making use of three new cards, and each of them is very synergistic. So some people are already, you know, a little leery of this deck. Obviously, Magic players love calling for bans. I mean, what are your impressions of it, Dan, having played it a couple times?
Having played it a couple times, I'm still on the fence about which card I want to ban. But I have some strong contenders for which card I want to ban. I mean, look, here the thing is, like, Hogak, I'm looking at this right now, it's a beautiful Magic card. It's terrifying and beautiful, and it just kind of makes you wonder what they were thinking. Who snuck this one through? Like, did they test it? Altered Dementia has always been, like, a casual hit. Like, it wasn't modern legal, so we didn't have to think about, like, how good would this be. But it turns out it's amazing. Like, if you know, you play Dredge, you know that, like, milling cards is equivalent to drawing cards, and Dredge is so broken because it does that for zero mana. Altar does the same thing, and then just the combination with Hogak and Bridge is a stunning amount of effects generated for no mana. So
yeah, the funniest part to me is that, you know, it's not like they were, you know, turn two playing a Sapling Migration and then convoking it out on turn four or turn five with your Sapling tokens. They literally make it so that you cannot cast it with mana, so you must cast it in a broken way. And so if you're testing it, the only way to test it is trying to do it in a broken way. And somehow still slip through the cracks. That's just what I find quite amusing.
Yeah, I think maybe it was even Kanner said, this card literally insists that you break it to try to use it. And so
yeah,
all it is an invitation.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah, it just prevents you from ever trying to do the fair thing. So it's like, if you're interested in this card, you have to do it for free. And it, once you do that for free, you maybe find all these cards quite quickly. And the internet did, I think even before the set was out, people were already posting lists or, you know, two or three cards off of these lists that people are top eighting with already. So, I mean, it's not like it takes a genius to do some of this work.
It took about 3 or 4 days since the card was previewed. I was able to pre-order some when they were cheap. Check that Twitter to see what was trending, but who knows if they'll actually arrive or if they'll be canceled or if the card will be banned before I ever get to play with it. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the card was broken in Modern, but, you know, as people were playing their first pre-releases in paper, just for reference. You still can't even buy it from most stores because the set isn't out for print yet.
Yeah, so what I find really challenging playing against the deck is that, like, it's the Ultra Dementia is the card that, like, really, it's a head-scratcher. Like, how do you fight this? Like, I'm used to playing against Dredge where, like, okay, they got a good start. Maybe they got out ahead of me. They're going to get their stuff into play, like, Vomit the Creatures into play, and maybe Creep and Chill me a few times. But, like, I'm going to get to untap, and, like, I'll have at least a chance to, like, do something to fight back. You don't get that chance against the Ultra because it's the turn that they play it, whether that's turn two or turn three. Like, okay, if they play the Ultra on turn two, you have one turn. On turn three, you will get milled out. And unfortunately, it's kind of cruel. It's not even like Splinter Twin where it's a clean kill. You have to, like, watch them do it, and, like, maybe they'll fizzle, but they probably won't. Or, like, maybe they'll fizzle, but, like, you're seeing them, like, accumulate Vengevines and Bloodghasts and Gravecrawlers, and it's like, I'm not going to win, even if they do fizzle. It's like the Bridgevine deck from last year, like, managed to just, like, cut. It had, like, three bad cards in that deck, and they've all been replaced with great cards in Carrion Feeder, Hogak, and Ulcer.
Yeah, and yeah. I would say, personally, Dan and I have a love for Carrion Feeder. We're really excited to, we had a bunch of lists brewed up that were, you know, somewhat fair, somewhat degenerate, and it's like, there's no sense even pursuing them while this list is out there. I mean, it's sort of like you say, it's a beautiful linear thing. I mean, it's cool that Magic players can break the format so fast, but it does seem like this list is not Neoform Allosaurus, where, you know, 60% of the time it works, 0% of the time. This list is like turn three or four is almost a lock. I mean, I have a hard time believing, you know, without a piece of hate by turn four, the deck is going to win a super high percentage of the time.
The deck does occasionally just kind of churn through 2/1s. I saw Dan win a game where the opponent just drew like five. I think Canister himself, actually, Dan faced. I think yes. Canister just drew like 6 lands and no real
cave
gas.
Cave Dan, better than Canister, confirmed.
And beat him down with some 2/2 and 1/1 Eldrazi Scions.
That was what the Aristocrat Citadel deck.
Yeah. What's interesting too is how is this deck going to work in paper? I mean, there's so many triggers and things to keep track of. You know, at least online keeps track of everything for you in nice clean piles.
Well, at least you don't have to keep track of how many spells you cast for Weather the Storm on a Citadel turn. Or how much luck you lost for the Children of Corvus when turn you play a Citadel.
Yeah, also, luckily, Weather the Storm is not going to be playable in tournaments, so that won't be much of a problem in paper either. So.
Yeah, I saw a judge call once in a Legacy tournament where the opponent of a Tin Fins player was like, my opponent claims he has a kill with Tendrils, but he wasn't really keeping track of how many spells he cast this turn. And it looks like it took a bit of a while to untangle that, so that's true, Dan. Yeah.
I do think one of the concerns I have is Wizards has shown in the past reticence to ban new cards. So they made a big deal that we tested all these Modern Horizon cards. We had our, you know, all these, you know, super talented people testing out in Modern. These cards are specifically designed for Modern. Even though the most broken cards seem to be from this new set, right? I think we've identified them. They typically will not ban the new card first. They'll probably ban Bridge from Below, if I had to guess, as the first card, because the egg on their face from having to ban Hogak before it's even printed in paper. Like Damon's talking about, it does look really bad if that's the case. But I guess, I mean, I don't know what they're going to do. Maybe something will happen that doesn't have to be banned. But what I'm seeing right now is that this deck is very powerful. It does fizzle sometimes, but it is not like some of these other decks that fizzle a reasonable percentage of the time, or even give you time to play your hate cards. I mean, Damon's describing a lot of scenarios where Rest in Peace doesn't actually change anything.
So I think that if you take away the Bridge, you will weaken the deck somewhat. It will still be a strong deck, and they'll have four slots to play with to put something better in, or at least functional. So like, if they want to like let the deck still shine, I think Bridge would make sense. Yeah, no one's going to miss Bridge.
That Great Bridge is one of the five or ten worst design cards of all time. It's modern legal, so I think it should just not exist in the format just because it's so stupid. I think Patrick Chapin once made a top eight of worst design cards, and this was like one or two just because it, like, it only works in one zone. It triggers on all kinds of other random things, and yeah, I mean.
Yeah, it sort of has a casting cost. You can cast it, and it literally does nothing.
Right.
So everyone's like, oh man, they resolved their Bridge. Let me disenchant it.
So maybe this is just like some next level move for them to get rid of Bridge finally to make it seem like its power level is high enough to justify banning.
I think strategically, like as someone who playing against the deck, the card that would help the most to see banned is Altar of Dementia, because then you just wouldn't have to worry about that angle of getting milled out. You want to worry about, like, do I need an artifact destruction card? You just know that, like, they're going to produce creatures. And, like, at least there you know what you're up against. You can play Graveyard Hate plus Sweepers or something. With the Altar in the picture, that might not be enough.
I was really surprised to see them reprint Altar, actually. But, I mean, you say it's a casual hit. It's really powerful in casual formats because things with no cost to do over and over again like that can be broken if you can just find a loop somewhere else. So,
yeah, Mark Rosewater has repeatedly said that he thinks that free sacrifice outlets with no mana cost are, like, bad gameplay, and that's why we'll just, like, never see it again in Standard, at least not with the text of, like, doing it any time. So I kind of given up hope on any kind of Aristocrat strategy for Modern forever, and then with Horizon, it's like, oh, please, please give us Carrion Feeder, and they did. And then they gave us Altar, too, and I was like, yes, I can't wait to brew these, like, fun Aristocrats decks, and then it's like, oh. So, yeah, I think if you're going to be in the queues right now, just don't touch graveyard decks right now. Just give it like a week. Give it 2 weeks and, like, let's see how this shakes out. If people, like, find ways to attack the deck, they're probably going to be packing a lot of graveyard hate, and you probably should too. Yeah, maybe that's not even a viable strategy for attacking the deck. Maybe you just have to go fast.
But to Damon's point, though, I mean, people are going to be ready for this deck. So if you're doing some incidental little graveyard thing that you think is kind of cute, that is going to get destroyed by the number of all the cards he listed. I mean, the people are going to be ready to roll on the graveyard. So you can't be, you know, casting Resurrection or something. I mean, that's not going to fly.
Refurbish? Hope that adds 8.
Refurbish, yeah. You don't want to be saying, I'm going to add 8 in your deck. That would be really stupid.
Yeah.
So, Damon, any thoughts on how to attack this deck?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, that you want Leyland of the Void as your number one card. And then Rest in Peace is kind of, I don't know if I say distant second, but solid second. And then Tormod's Crypt, Relic, Ravenous Trap are all decent. But Surgical, I tried a Surgical them once. I had a Stony Silence and a Surgical, and it just did absolutely nothing to them. Just it was kind of funny how little it did.
Which card did you Surgical?
Honestly, I don't even remember. It didn't really matter.
You had the full set of cards to choose from at that point.
Yeah, I think I may have hit a Bloodgast because that was all they were showing at that point in time, and then they did a couple other operations, and then the game was over. I think at some point had a bunch of cards in the graveyard, and they just cast a Hogak, and I was like, oh, that's an 8/8, and it's turn 2.
And the other thing that Dan said that I agree with is you can also go fast. I mean, you can play a non-interactive deck yourself and try to race them. You know, Poison's an option, some of the Prowess decks. They're not going to interact with you. They do not play very much removal. I've seen one or two cards, maybe. And
exactly. They bring in Nature's Claims, Thought Seizes, and, like, maybe Assassin's Trophy. And, like, that's the only one that can kill a creature.
Yeah, so
Containment Priest would have been a great printing for this.
I was stunned they didn't reprint Containment Priest, actually, but they just realized what we needed is more ways to cheaply mill yourself and non-interactive graveyard decks. That's what Modern was missing, and, you know, you have to credit WotC for having the vision to approach their design philosophy that correctly. I mean, that's just how it is.
Yeah, if you want a hot spec, get your Yixlid Jailers. I think that's what we need. We need a creature that hoses the graveyard, because that will at least force them to play less efficient answer cards. Yeah, I think in terms of, like, real strategy, I think the best way to attack it is to, like, go even more linear and kill them on turn 3. They don't block well. Like, Gravecrawler doesn't block, Carrion Feeder does not block. So, yeah, I saw a tweet from Daniela Diaz, Spanish streamer. Holy Diva.
Shout out to Holy Diva.
Tweeted that the best hate card for this deck, David, you can probably guess what it was.
Thing in the Ice? What does she love?
Team or Battle Rage.
Oh, yeah.
Best hate card for this deck. But, this is like the blue deck, B-L-O-O deck.
Yeah, she plays that one in red, 1/2 elemental that gets +3/+0 whenever you cast a spell, instant sorcery.
Yeah, so I mean that seems to work. Like you can win the race against them. They cannot stop you that way. But I mean that's not a format that is really. It's kind of disappointing for me as a brewer. I was kind of expecting that there would be like a grace period of a couple weeks where the set comes out, people are like tinkering with new stuff, trying to find some diamonds in the rough. You can play your deck that's maybe not tuned yet, maybe it's still tier 2, and like play against other decks that are a little rough. But you can work out like what's working. I have learned that many of my builds just get completely destroyed by Hogak, and like I knew that already. Like I don't need to learn that again. So a little bit disappointing, but that's just where we're at right now.
Scale Up is both a great card in Poison and in Prowess decks, so maybe that's a card to pursue. It's effectively a +7/+7 to a Prowess creature, and it's effectively +12/+12 to a Poison creature. So, you know, we're not going to talk about Scale Up lists. I think we're going to just wait for the Carnage to settle on this. We do have a card we're kind of excited about talking about. It is Ranger Captain of Eos, which is, do you want to tell us what it does, Dan?
Oh, I have to do this from memory, sorry. If you have it in front of you, maybe one of you guys can read it. I know you can sacrifice it to remove a bridge.
One white for a 3/3 human soldier. When Ranger Captain of Eos enters the battlefield, you may search your library for a creature card with converted mana cost 1 or less. Reveal it, put it into your hand, then shuffle your library. So it's a callback to Ranger of Eos. And then it has an additional line of text, which is quite powerful and modern, actually. Sacrifice Ranger Captain of Eos, : your opponents can't cast non-creature spells this turn. So this card does a lot of things. It's a card advantage engine. The sacrifice effect is actually a little relevant against Bridge from Below. I've actually seen Canister lose to somebody destroying it in the middle of his combo turn, getting rid of his bridges. Damon, it kind of stuck out to you as a card worth brewing around. Do you want to talk about the list you kind of threw together?
Yeah, my first reaction was just, you know, how does this Eos military system work? Is a Ranger Captain, do they outrank a Ranger? Are they like a lower rank? It seems like they're a lower rank, but I don't know about that one.
Well, he's stronger, but he recruits less troops, so it's hard to say.
He's cheaper, so it seems lower rank, but yeah, it's tougher stats. He goes to the gym more.
It's like an org chart. The higher you go up, like he only has to report to one person or something like that.
Oh, so the Ranger, the creature they find is the boss.
I'm not exactly sure, but I want to know more now.
Yeah, so the list I first thought of with this card, we talked about a couple weeks ago just as a very briefly, and that's Martyr Proc, in particular because of the new card God Eternal Oketra. I guess no longer, it's old news by now. And the way this deck works is a little funky. One of the things it wants to do is, like, the Dream Start is somehow like turn one Martyr of Sands, turn two Squadron Hawk, fetch a bunch of, you know how Amulet Titan gets called Squadron Titan sometimes? Squadron Hawk is the original Squadron, the OG. And so you search up three more Squadron Hawks, and then you use your Martyr of Sands to gain a gajillion life. And then maybe you start casting a Ranger of Eos to either find you more Martyrs or whatever. And then ultimately you try to cast like a Sera Ascendant, who becomes a one mana for a 6/6 lifelink as long as you're above 30 life. So first is that all this incidental life gain gives you some easy wins against Burn and Zoo type decks. You buy enough time to cast a couple of the sweepers in the deck. And secondly, the life gain triggering Sera Ascendant gives you a super cheap, you know, one mana 6/6 flyer that you can find two of Ranger of Eos gives you an interesting angle against control where that's just a really efficient rate. So it kind of plays out like this weird mono white control deck featuring a couple Emeria the Sky Rune. And so what I was curious about is the deck already played Ranger of Eos to find the Sera Ascendants and things like that. Is Ranger Captain of Eos just like a cheaper card that, even though it's slightly less value, gives you this new angle of the can't casting spells aspect? In particular, Martyr Proc being a mono white control deck could A, run as many Rest in Pieces as you want in the sideboard, and B, it's not insane to run a couple Rest in Peace main. We've seen this in the blue white control decks. And so if we're really concerned about running into a lot of graveyard decks, a couple rips main will go a long, long way. A lot of times against graveyard decks, running out of turn 2 Rest in Peace on game 2 will slow them down a lot or possibly win the game, but sometimes they'll just have an answer to it. But game 1, frequently, they're just stone dead. They have no answers to a turn 2 rip, besides just steadily casting a bunch of crappy 2/1s and 4/3s. So that was where I wanted to start. So I took kind of a standard Martyr Proc shell and then mixed in three Ranger Captain of Eos, three Ranger of Eos, some God Eternal Aketras. Have you guys played this shell? I know, Dan, you've taken it through a league a long time ago.
It's been a little while since I played it. Maybe it's been a month or something. I wanted to actually ask you about what you were saying about Rest in Peace, because my understanding was that you can't play Rest in Peace, or you shouldn't, unless you're really confident that it's going to win the game, because it does mess with your recursion plan. I mean, this deck plays Flagstones of Trocaire and Ghost Quarter, and the first planes that you usually fetch with Flagstones is Mistveil Plains, which allows you to recycle your Squadron Hawks into your deck, so that as long as you have a Squadron Hawk in your hand, you'll never run out of the squad. Similarly, like, you can get away with only playing like 3 Sarah Ascendants, because, you know, one dies, you put it back, and you'll just draw another Ranger to like find it again. That's all well and good if there's not a Rest in Peace in play. If there is a Rest in Peace in play, like, you can't do that, and you have to actually, like, you might run out of threats if they kill them all. So I actually think you don't see Rest in Peace main deck, and I think a lot of the stock burner lists only play one or two in the sideboard, but maybe that was for a different meta. Maybe they'd be really happy to go to four, as you've got sketched out for us here. Do you think that, like, the recursion is an important angle of this deck, or are you thinking, like, we can move away from that with more of, like, a heavier beatdown plan?
My view is that if Rest in Peace is live against your opponent, the value of recurring your Squadron Hawks is just so much less than the value on completely shutting down their graveyard plan. And you can beat the deck through more conventional means. Typically, the decks where you're grinding with Squadron Hawks are not the decks where Rest in Peace is live. They're just trying to kill you really, really fast, and it's not like you're just running out of your squad. I'm sure there are decks that are kind of in the middle, like is it Phoenix, for example. Rest in Peace is good, but also being able to hear Squadron Hawks is good, and so it's kind of in the middle where there is a bit of a tension there. But I think on the whole, in a lot of matchups, you either play the rip or you can just not play it at all. One card I don't have in this list I'd like to discuss is Smuggler's Copter, namely the optimal number to play. I think that card will give you a nice outlet for matches where Rip is dead to mill it. And actually, I think synergizes as well with the Squadron Hawk plan. Sometimes you just, you know, Squadron Hawk into a bunch of Hawks in your hand, and you're like, what do I do with them? I just cast a bunch of 2-mana 1/1 flyers. It's cool, but it's not that cool.
Did you play any Smuggler's Copter, or do you suggest having some in the deck?
I didn't try that yet, but I would like to try that. I took this list through a preliminary league just to get a sense for it. And I was only playing 3 Rest in Peace. I was like, I can probably just, you know, only play one in the sideboard plus some Surgicals. And then I played against Hogak. And, you know, the phrase spitting into the wind, it felt like spitting into a fire hose. Surgical was not enough. So I'm back on 4 Rip in the 75. And then the Planeswalkers felt kind of iffy. They tended to just kind of die. And so I think it is not a bad cut for them. I mean, to some extent, God Eternal Aketra is now the new Planeswalker in the sense that what a Planeswalker is meant to do is be a resilient source of value at its kind of fundamental level, and Oketra fills that need.
Yeah, that was kind of the sense I got. You know, I think we were both drawing up lists. Damon, I got pretty close to where you were at. I had a few questions about cards that you weren't playing and maybe, you know, what your thought process was. So I played, I think, one league of this way back when we were considering, when we went to GP Hartford and Dan and I were considering playing this. I think you want to play the full 4-star Ascendance, especially because in my experience, and again, maybe this was a different metagame, the true nut draw is turn 1, Sarah Ascendant, turn 2, Martyr Sand Sacket, attack with a 6-6 Sarah Ascendant. That can just steal games against decks that you quote-unquote have a bad matchup against. So I think at least to start, I'd want all 4 Sarah Ascendants main. Did you give any thought to that, or your thought was, you know, we're a full control deck, and we're not worried about that type of draw, really. We're trying to play a longer game.
Yeah, I mean, I would not say I'm an experienced Martyr Prog pilot. I think you guys have as much, maybe more experience than me with the deck. The deck has just lots of little ways it gets value, like the Emeria, the Sky Rune. It plays 2 of those, so late game you can start returning your guys. Some lists play Proclamation of Rebirth, and then, yeah, there's a Sarah Ascendant aggro line. And what I've been finding was just that Sarah Ascendant was one of the weaker cards to get early on. You frequently can't get Martyr going super early. Sometimes you have to dig for it with a Ranger or Ranger Captain, somebody from Eos.
Yeah.
And that takes time. And then in that time, you know, playing a 1-mana 1/1 lifelink just really doesn't do that much for you. And so if you're waiting for a Ranger of Eos, then you may as well just wait for them to find the Sarah Ascendant. But maybe I'm undervaluing the aggro line you mentioned. That's a fair point.
My experience was that if your opening hand contains both Sarah Ascendant and Martyr of Sands, I would usually play the Martyr first. I would play the Martyr on turn 2 and sack it immediately, and then play the Sarah Ascendant on turn 3, like, so they don't have a chance to lightning bolt it. So I think that, I mean, that question is like almost entirely meta dependent, and like you have to have a soul read on your opponent or have scouted them to like know whether a turn one ascendant is safe or not. And I think the default was like it's not safe. You know, your deck is built for the long game. You're playing like up to four Wrath of Gods or something. I don't know. And yeah, I think three copies is plausible. I am a card-carrying member of the Murder Proc Discord, so I think three copies of Sarah Ascendant is defensible, and yeah, you'll find lists with both three and four.
But would you recommend it, Daniel?
Oh, I'd have to ask the experts in Discord.
The Discord, I see. The other question I had was all the removal. You know, you're playing three Wrath effects, you're playing four Path to Exile and one Condemn. Did you feel like cast out, I guess that's a catch-all effect. Did you feel like that was too many, or like what decks are you trying to beat with all the removal?
Path is just a good card against Izzet Phoenix and just like a lot of random decks you might have trouble with. Hey, Path is just a good card in Modern these days. There's a lot of creatures you want to interact with at instant speed for cheap. Any sort of like devoted Druid deck is also great there. The Wraths are good as a nice catch-all. This deck can frequently rebuild from a Wrath without a whole lot of problems, and it really is what gives it an angle to control and risk the game going long. Without the Wraths to clean up, you could run into a lot of trouble as a creature decks just steadily amass guys, and frequently the creatures will work synergistically. Like, for example, humans, you can path a few guys, but eventually all their guys become like 8/8s with Thalia's Lieutenants and things like that. And so you need a clean house every so often.
Which is, again, why the recursion element of the deck is so important to the game one plan, because like there isn't a plan for beating creature decks apart from like, well, I'll just Wrath them out. Yeah, and in that sense, your creatures are disposable because you're going to get them back.
Yeah. I will tell you, though, that Oketra is a pretty, like, I played it once, and it was amazing.
Yeah, so
as soon as you want to tap with Oketra, you tend to win.
I mean, that was my sense, is, okay, we're adding Oketra, which means we're going to oftentimes have a dominant board. So I'm wondering if we can cut some of these Wraths and do something else instead. But, I mean, is humans even playable in a world with Hogak? They just literally can't do anything, so...
Actually, apparently humans, I've heard different things, but I've heard that humans runs four ley line, and then they have a good disruption plan for any deck. They, you know, they can freeboot your altar, things like that. And I've heard humans actually can have a decent matchup.
Really? Yeah, well,
I've heard that as well. I think it's because of what we were saying about the Hogak deck does not play creature removal, or perhaps cannot play creature removal. Well, maybe it can, but it doesn't. So like, if you meddling mage naming Hogak, they just can't cast it anymore. And then, you know, they can bring in Anafenza, who I think is a great card right now. You know, if you're still alive, you cast Anafenza, that's probably just going to stick around.
You can play a turn two with Hierarch.
Yeah,
and then you have your Ley Lines, like Damo was saying. So I think humans is going to be a good choice if you just want like a safe deck to play with right now in the current, you know, whatever week this is, in the current meta.
Yeah. But yeah, so Oketra, it felt like, you know, like if you untap with the Jace the Mind Sculptor, you tend to win the game. And Oketra felt kind of similar in the sense that this deck pretty easily stockpiles a bunch of creatures in their hand, either via Squadron Hawks will just let you have Hawks in hand for days, Ranger Vios alone will get you two more creatures, Ranger Captain will get you two activations. You know, once I cast a Walking Ballista the same turn, it's got Eternal Oketra for zero, and immediately got a 4/4. And then once you start vomiting out 4/4 Vigilance dudes, along with Oketra herself, I'm actually not sure. Oketra themselves is a very respectable attacker swinging in for six every turn. It's very hard to block effectively, and it's very resilient once it comes into play. That's why it really felt kind of like a Planeswalker, and as a result, maybe the Gideons no longer really are necessary. If your opponent wants to double bolt your God Eternal Oketra, it's really not a big deal. If they double bolt your Gideon Allies Zendikar, it's kind of annoying. Or, you know, in one case, it was like a Lava Spike plus Bolt.
Still trying to wrap my head around this list, Damon, and I can't quite do it. Like, I know what Murder Proc is, and I hear what you're saying. It all makes sense, but it's like the play pattern you're describing breaks the rules of Modern. Like, everything I know about Modern says you cannot just play a 5-drop for 5 mana that doesn't have an ETB effect, and then, like, untap with it, and then get value next turn. You know, I'm used to, like, 5 mana plays that, like, will give you some value right now, but with the Ranger Captain, you now have a 3-drop. You can go, like, 1-drop, 2-drop, 3-drop, 4-drop, 5-drop. And, like, yep, that sounds great, but, like, won't you just be dead? Like, I don't know. I mean, so, like, this deck, yeah, I guess you're still assuming the Murder Proc stance of, like, you know, come at me, I'll gain my life. I don't care about these creatures. I have more. They're all 2-for-1s or 3-for-1s. Especially if we're adding Smuggler's Coppers, like, are we beat down a little more? Are we trying to curve out more, or are we still like eyes on the prize? We're still trying to settle in and wrath them and then win eventually.
I would say that the goal of Smuggler's Copter is that this deck, first off, has two problems sometimes. One is that Squadron Hawk is a very slow clock, and sometimes you just don't draw the creatures with, you know, more than one power. There aren't that many of them. And even three power creatures are still not a super fast clock. And then as a mono white deck, the only real card draw you have is Thraben Inspector, which kind of really is just cycling itself to some extent. And so Smuggler's Copter gives you really good filtering. There's matchups where your Wraths will be dead. There's matchups where lots of different cards will be dead, or you can just avoid flooding out. Smuggler's Copter is a card that is actually quite powerful. It was so good it was banned in Standard. Hasn't really seen too much traction in Modern, but I still haven't quite figured out. You know, it actually sometimes sees play in Legacy Merfolk, and once my opponent cast it, I was like, man, that card is actually pretty good right here. And I know your comparison to a 5 CMC card that generates a lot of ETB value, whose name starts with N and ends in Niv-Mizzet.
Thank you for solving the puzzle.
And it's true, but this deck gains one thing that deck doesn't have, and that's an amazing mana base. It gets to play 4 Field of Ruin and 4 Ghost Quarter, and this actually turns a couple matchups into somewhere between easy mode to pretty reasonable. So against any sort of Tron variant, you can just pretty...
That is a horrible matchup for this deck.
I don't think it is. I mean, I think you have so much land kill, they run out, and I think you can start, there's some cards you can play in the sideboard that give you extra help. I'm not going to say Tron is a great matchup, but my understanding from this is it's not a terrible matchup.
I will fight you on that. You play these cards... Okay, you play Field of Ruin and Ghost Quarter because you can, and secondarily because you need to thin lands out of your deck because you're doing so much creature thinning that, you will flood out otherwise. Yeah, they're upside, and they're also necessary, but, don't fool yourself into thinking that you're going to beat Tron just with those, because, you're not going to kill them before they naturally hit 6 lands. Once they're playing these cards, an Ugin is just going to beat you. So it's still a hard matchup. Everything I've heard from... Well, okay, I'm going to say this, and now I'm going to get messaged by someone from Murder Proc being like, well, actually, it's actually not that bad. But I think it's a bad matchup, and my understanding is that it's just not a good matchup. You need to clock them, and this deck has a hard time doing that. But maybe that's going to change. Maybe that's one of the reasons why this edition of Ranger Captain will significantly change that matchup profile, is that you can more quickly come at them with the Sarah Ascendant.
I think certainly, I'm not going to claim this is going to be the best deck in Modern right now, no doubt. I think it just might be worth revisiting. And I think we'll take a little bit more playtesting. Things have changed a lot since then. There's more Karn the Great Creator, which is frequently chippable away with little creatures.
Another couple cards people might want to consider are a couple of Cavernous Souls. You can main deck that card very easily, maybe over your fourth Ghost Quarter or the second Mistvane Plains, or you could play less than 8 planes if you wanted.
What would be the goal of including Cavern of Souls?
Resolving your creatures against blue-white.
So you put it on humans, typically, because of all the Eos dudes are humans. Thraben Inspector, Sarah Ascendant, Martyr of Sands are all humans, because blue-white really cares if you resolve a Martyr of Sands.
Well, the key part is that if you resolve one of your humans, you get to draw 2 cards that they, in theory, also have to counter. So,
a Ranger actually is good to get uncounterable. I agree with that. Sorry,
both of the Rangers.
With the Martyr.
Both of the Rangers are pretty good. Because against control, one 3-power guy is enough to hassle Planeswalker or whatever.
The one issue with Cavern is that the deck's mana base looks like, oh, mono white, you can do whatever. But you're going to have to cut something. I mean, you need a high Planescale for Emeria, and Cavern just doesn't meet that. 7 planes is already really hard as is. And then if you're playing these non-basics, it'll get just that much harder. And then because of your fields and ghost quarters, having double white for a lot of these key cards is not always the easiest thing. And Cavern does kind of cut into that planes count.
Yeah, I think that if you wanted to find room in the mana base, you could trim one Emeria and maybe one Misfill Planes, but I would not trim any basic planes. But I think, this is such a weird deck because it's been around forever. This is, there was a really nice post on Modern about the history of Modern and when archetypes appear. And Murder Proc has been there since almost the beginning. But, the mana base has been kind of grandfathered in. It was sort of finalized in a period when control was just not playable. So we never really had to ask ourselves, how much does Cavern add to the plan? Now, blue-white is back, and with a vengeance, and I think it might be worth thinking about that. I'm not totally sure that this deck supports it, but I think it's not a crazy suggestion, Dave. It might actually help.
I will tell you, anytime I play this deck, I will be playing at least two Cavern of Souls in my main deck. It's not a question to me. I understand what you guys are saying, but I don't like... I just feel like it is fair to say that the blue-white and the mono-blue decks don't play that many counterspells, but when your Ranger Captain of Eos gets Archmage Charmed and you're cursing the skies, just know that you did it to yourself.
Ah, it's a one-for-one trade. They're playing less cryptics now.
All right, hey, that's there it is.
I feel like blue-based control is better than it's ever been. It's Archmage's Charm is real. That card is really annoying.
Well, that's why I'm saying we should play Cavern of Souls. So,
yeah, anyway. I'm listening.
So yeah, I think that it's worth exploring what Damon's talking about. You know, Ranger Captain of Eos gives you a cheaper option. It's a little less clunky. It's another card advantage engine. It's another card that can target your sort of combo pieces. God Eternal Oketra is a little more speculative, but you know, I think it's worth trying out, especially when you have all these 2-for-1s built in. You do definitely speed up your clock when you resolve it, if that's a concern.
Yeah, I think that the question that I would have going into the matches would be like, does the inclusion of these cards, Ranger Captain and God Eternal Oketra, like actually change the plan of the deck? Or is it more of the same? It is more of an effect that the deck already wants. Does that move the needle on like how fast we are, or like whether we start attacking sooner, or the lines we can take?
Yeah. One thing I should mention, by the way, is that Martyr Proc kind of feels like chicken soup for the leagues. It feels like one of the most absolute fair things you could be doing. And it's a little
whether
bit
that's a good thing or a bad thing is an open question.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not going to claim again that if you define good thing as you know, winning a lot, it's not clear to me that's going to be the case. But it is clear that it's just an interesting game plan to try to execute in Modern. It'll make you shake up your thought patterns a little bit as you try to figure out how to take this deck to win.
If you consider trying to win by timing the opponent out on Magic Online to be like chicken soup for the soul, yeah, that will happen. Like that is a serious part of the game plan of Martyr Proc, is to time them out.
Well, Dan, you're a slower clicker, so I think some people are going to be able to finish in time.
Some people. Well, if you recall, Martyr Proc won like a PTQ online a few months ago, and like it defeated Blue White Amulet in the top 8, both by timing them out.
Wow, I didn't know that.
By any means possible. Survive in advance, kids. Don't.
Exactly. Play fast if you're playing this deck.
Absolutely. Which part of what Dan is saying is you have to assign your role early. So if you are the more fair deck, you have to play the slower game. And in the cases where you need to, they have inevitability, which is hopefully not that often, you need to be the person, you know, resolving your 2-mana 1/1 flying creatures and getting in there.
So is there any consideration for the card Giver of Runes in this deck, the Mother of Runes variant? 1-mana,
yeah.
1/2, taps to protect a creature?
Absolutely. As soon as I fired up the league and I was like, played my first Ranger Captain, I was like, oh yeah, shouldn't I have that card be fetchable? That would be a great additional, at least a one of. I'm not sure if you really want to have, you know, is this a card you want to have on turn one every game? I suspect in this list, probably not. I suspect that having one available to fetch off your Rangers would be sufficient. Do you think we would need more?
I don't actually think the first one is that playable, but I think you should always consider anything you can tutor for.
That's true. To some extent, all your creatures are meant to be expendable.
Yeah, I mean, if we're playing Wrath of God in a deck with like 23 creatures, I think we're saying we're fine with them casting Lightning Bolt or whatever and resolving it on various creatures.
That's a good point. I think that sort of Death and Taxes players are excited about that card because they have high value 2-drops that they actually care about, and maybe we don't.
Yeah.
The other card I would recommend if we're thinking about going long is like a 1 Weathered Wayfarer. It does give you ability to draw cards in the late game, and it does tutor for special effects if that's something that you want. If you only want to play, let's say, 1 Cavern or 1 Mistveil Plains or 1 Emeria, you could fetch it with your Weathered Wayfarer that is targetable by the 6 Ranger effects we're playing. And we will often be down cards because we'll be ghost quartering Tron or whatever.
I suppose. I guess I had assumed that card had been vetted and discarded, but maybe it's worth considering. Like, I know that Walking Ballista snuck in as a one of and has become a fixture in the deck, so I think there's definitely room for like useful tutor targets. Another card to ask about was Force of Virtue, the white force from Modern Horizons that is a crusade for your team, but you can cast it for free on the opponent's turn by exiling a white card from your hand, such as an extra Squadron Hawk. Do you think that card has any home with this kind of deck, or is that just misidentifying the purpose of a murder proc deck.
Yeah, it seems like it's a little bit too much built around being kind of on the aggressive, whereas this deck is a little bit more on the controlling, like react to your opponent's game plan, adapt and stop some elements of it, and then slowly build a presence through the white value engines. But, you know, certainly worth experimenting with. And then one question I have is just, how good is this Ranger Captain's sacrifice ability? In the one league I was playing, I found it to be interestingly, like, playing your 3-drop and then sacking it is actually a pretty big cost. And so you better be getting a lot of value. You know, even if you got a Thraben Inspector, it still is just like you're putting a lot of mana into this effect as like a tempo, anti-tempo swing. Like if your opponent is on Phoenix and it's like, yeah, you could maybe, if they play like a Metamorphose, you can sack it in response and then they can't get the Phoenix into play that turn. But won't they just do it next turn and now you don't have a 3-3? So I'm curious to see how good it is. I mean, interestingly, it would be really good against Lotus Bloom decks if somebody's trying to cheat a Citadel into play.
Or Ancestral Visions or something like that. But I do agree, like, doing it proactively into nothing, like, speculatively, that is, you better really have the soul read.
The easy example is when they Miracle Trigger a Terminus. That's, like, the textbook case.
Sure. Don't see too many Terminuses these days. It seems like Blue-White's kind of moved to more of a Planeswalker build, but...
Yeah, and the second case being when they cast Electrodominance.
Oh, there you go.
Case in the textbook.
You know, it is just a straight up 2-for-1 even without that ability. So, I mean, it's just kind of a nice to have. It's nice to remember that it's there. It's easy to forget about. So,
yeah, honestly, costing 3 versus 4 is no joke. I mean, Ranger of Eos is a powerful card, but 4 mana is a ton.
Yes.
So you just draw 3 of them and you're sitting there like wondering when you'll be able to cast them.
So I alluded to the fact that I had Ranger Captains in some of my Citadel builds, and I basically agree with everything you're saying about the sacrifice effect. It was a corner case thing more than anything else. Like, you do get paired against these Ancestral Vision type decks some of the time, and in my builds I was actually trying to protect a spell like a Shape Anew or something. It was good for that, but for protecting against Wrath, it doesn't really work. Like, you'll
Well, and you don't want to protect against Wrath in a deck that's playing 3 Wrath effects main, so, I mean...
Yeah, this deck doesn't have anything it wants to protect. There's that.
It does remove bridges, though. Just shout out to the kids.
That's probably the most common usage.
Yeah.
I'm expecting that to be the most common usage if we...
But it's a very real thing to do, is play that on your turn if they have a bridge or two, and you're not dead already, for whatever reason. You can proactively do it.
Ditto for Murder of Sands.
All right, so I also thought this card was cool. I propose a list that is using mana guys to try to play what's better than Ranger Captain of Eos on 4, a Ranger Captain of Eos on 3, a Ranger Captain of Eos on 2. And this deck would, in theory, make use of the Ranger Captain ability. I'm proposing using Ugin's Conjurant with Celestial Kirin. So Celestial Kirin is an old card from Kamigawa block. It is 2 white-white, legendary creature, Kirin Spirit, 3/3 flying. Whenever you play a spirit or arcane spell, destroy all permanents with that spell's mana cost. Like a lot of older cards, it does not include the key text non-land. You play Ugin's Conjurant for 0, you destroy all lands. So you kind of build your own Armageddon that costs 2 cards. But Ranger Captain of Eos can search for a card with casting cost 1 or less. You get to play your 8 mana creatures, so 4 Birds of Paradise, 4 Noble Hierarch, but then Celestial Kirin also lets you search up the Ugin's Conjurant. So you get to play 4 of them, plus you get 3 tutor effects. I'm proposing playing 3. You could play the full 4. So it's pretty consistent to actually have this effect in your hand whenever you have a Celestial Kirin in play. And because Ranger Captain of Eos can be sacrificed before you cast the Kirin that turn, you basically protect your Armageddon. So it's an Armageddon that can't be countered. And then the rest of the deck is all just sort of value green-white cards. So Thalia, Guardian of Thraben is kind of a cool effect. Once you've Wrathed, it makes all their spells more expensive, so they're hard to cast. If you have Voice of Resurgence in play, and for some reason you don't have Ranger Captain, and they do something to disrupt your Celestial Kirin on your turn, then you get a counter. Knight of the Reliquary gets super big once you've Wrathed of God, so it really speeds up the clock. And then Vivian, Champion of Wilds, is a card. Basically, since we started playing with Knight of the Reliquary and Kiora a couple weeks ago, I was really intrigued by any Planeswalker that lets you use Knight and still attack with it. So not a lot of Planeswalkers untap, but Vivian and I think one of the White Ajani's gives a creature Vigilance, which is basically the same thing, That's a super sweet ability with Knight. A lot of the big problem with Knight is how slow it is because you have to use it the first couple turns. So this really kind of lets you go off. And then Vivian lets you play your creatures with Flash. So against control decks or decks are going to try to interact with your creature spells, you could Flash in Celestial Cairn at end of turn. And it also finds your combo pieces because it looks at the top four cards of your deck twice.
Top three cards.
Oh, is that? Well, whatever. Over the course of two turns, you can look at six cards and you can help find your Celestial Cairn. So yeah, that's where I'm at on this.
So my initial reaction is that, okay, so Wizards actually mentioned this combo in their May 20th ban restricted announcement. They put it right up with Neoform Allosaurus Rider and Karn the Great Creator plus Mycosynth Lattice. So clearly they hold this combo in high esteem.
Really? They actually listed it as a combo that they were, what, like, modern?
Yeah, we're aware of some concerns about combos in Modern based around War of the Spark cards, such as Neoform, blah, blah, Ugin's Conjurer plus Celestial Cairn, and Karn the Great Creator, dot, dot, dot.
Help is coming. Wait for our Hogek preview next week.
Everything's good now. Nobody cares about Neoform Allosaurus Rider. Yeah, so I guess the question I have is that, is it worth doing that much work to get an Armageddon? You know, it's not like a one-sided Armageddon. It's a two-sided Armageddon. And you've built a deck to minimize the damage. Is that really a hoop that's worth spending that many slots to jump through?
Yeah, it's possible it isn't. I mean, I built it before Hogak was a deck. So it proactively deals with major pillars of the format. So Control is very mana-hungry, and obviously Amulet and Tron are very mana-hungry. So you just have reasonable matchups against... You know, I don't know what percent of the metagame that is, but, you know, that's a reasonable chunk of decks you'll see commonly. It's obviously not very good against humans or burn or something like that.
I mean, I played Blue Moon against humans a million times, and sometimes you just resolve a Blood Moon and they just can't cast anything.
Sure. But I do think that, again, in a non-Hogak-dominated world, you do just get enough just off of the ability to Armageddon that kind of steals games against a reasonable percentage of the field. And then even without your Armageddon effect, I mean, you're still playing a 4-mana 3-3 flyer. That is way below the curve. But the rest of your cards are just reasonable. You know, 2-for-1-like effects. Thalia is reasonable against, you know, some number of decks.
So if you have the combo assembled with the Cairn in play, you don't have to play Conjurant on 0. You could play it on a different number to destroy whatever you had to destroy.
Yes.
Although that would probably hit something you have. I'm just trying to, like, imagine in what scenarios... would this Armageddon not be useful? And it would be a scenario where either they've already got a more advantageous board than you, in which case the trigger still helps, hopefully, or when they're trying to kill you with something else that destroying permanents does not interact with. And in that case, you're kind of SOL, like this is not going to help you with that.
So you're saying, think of it as like an engineered explosive that's a little bit less finicky to cast and activate.
Yeah, and it leaves you with a 2-2 or a 1-1 or a 0-0.
Yeah, 0-0.
Yeah,
exile those bridges. I mean, having a 0-mana creature that dies is actually useful against Bridge from Below. Funny enough,
I will just say that Ugin's Conjurant is a great card in draft. I thought it looked silly, like it looked like I had a drawback, but it's like that drawback is mostly irrelevant. Having to remove counters, it's just like an XX for X. You can play that and it'll perform fine. I've played plenty of Endless Ones in Eldrazi decks. They're fine. Sometimes you just need a Gurmag Angler-sized creature for whatever turn of the game that is. It's like a fine card to draw in those situations.
One question is, green-white decks typically, you know, like to run the card Collective Company. It looks like you have a lot of hits here, although Ugin's Conjurant is not a hit. And then I'll just ask, because I'm surprised you haven't asked already, Dave, on your own list, is a certain 3-4 Angel with Flash that we seem to love.
That many come into play abilities. I think just Ranger Captain of Eos has one in the
deck.
That's
true.
And I guess the assumption is that at some point you are going to blow up land, so I'm really trying to minimize the number of 4-drops. But I think Celestial Cairn is the only one in there. Everything else is 3, so your deck is pretty low to the ground. And Ugin's Conjurant does give you outs to, you know, various... It can blow up, whatever, Pyromancer's Ascension. It can blow up Dark Confidant.
So what's interesting about this particular combo is that although it is creature based, the usual tutor effects like Collected Company or Court of Calling do not really help you that much. Like the Collected Company doesn't hit the Cairn. You don't want to hit the Conjurant with it. The Cairn is a cast trigger, so you want the Conjurant in your hand. Like you can cheat the Cairn into play, like tutor it directly in the play, but you want the conjurant to actually be cast. So Vivian does that. Court of Calling does not. There's the card Elid Amri's Call from whatever set that was from, Plane Shift or something, has now been added to Modern.
Yep.
Have you considered that, Dave, as like another way to find this, or is that just too slow?
I think that's a reasonable add. I guess I like the other things that Vivian could do. Like I always like to have cards like Eldamri's Call is only good if the combo is great, right? Because you're spending 6 mana for a 3/3 flyer at the end of the day. But Vivian lets you do other stuff. It makes your Knight of the Reliquary like way better, which is important, and it searches for cards. And being able to play things at flash speed is very important. So I think it just does enough other stuff. Obviously, it's a much worse tutor, but it makes your other generic cards better. That's, I guess, why I prefer it. But I'm open to the idea that just straight up, because the combo doesn't just straight up win the game, I'm not as willing to play cards that can only interact with the combo.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how Vivian specifically performs. I know, you know, we're talking about Ranger Captain being like a perfect card, and I think it is a perfect for this deck, but I think I am going to set the bar high for Vivian because she is like competing with other stuff that I'd be more interested in. Like Little Teferi, I think, would be a great splash here. But I mean, maybe flash is what this deck needs. Like you play Vivian, you assemble. I mean, they don't get to see what you found off the Vivian, so you can kind of bluff them. And like at any given time, once the Vivian's in play, you can sort of flash Armageddon them. But I mean, is that really worth it? It's kind of slow. Like it's 3 mana to draw some cards, whereas like, you know, Little Teferi protects you as well and will like get their thing off the board if you're worried about some permanent they have in play.
As a quick counterpoint, 3 mana Vivian has seen some play in Legacy Maverick, which is a green-white deck. I'm not sure it's seen like a ton of play, but yes, it's people have tried it. I think it came in a sideboard in a recent challenge of the second place deck.
Vivian's great in Standard as well, so it's not that she's not a good card. But
yeah, one card I have a question about is Ramunap Excavator. That's a very good way to get asymmetric value out of Wrath effects.
Out of Armageddon effects.
Sorry, Armageddon effects. Like Wrath for lands.
Yes.
What do you think of it, Damon?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if you could maybe just play that over, for example. I think it might just be a better card than Courser of Crucifix. Not that Courser is like a bad card, but just I feel like Ramunap Excavator will do a lot of work in this deck. You might be able to play some Field of Runes, and you can just use those over and over again. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I thought about it. I guess my thought was if I have Armageddon the board, I don't care about getting lands in play. I probably at least have a 3/3 in play, if not something else. And Courser gives you value, and I mean, the one thing that these decks struggle with is card draw. I could see it maybe as a one-of over, like, a Voice or one of the Vivians.
I've played more green-white decks in Modern than I would care to admit. Not a green archetype, unfortunately. And the general conclusion I've taken from all that experience is that Courser of Crucifix ranges from pretty good to great, and you can play up to 4 copies if the metagame calls for it, whereas Excavator just isn't as good as it looks in any situation. Like, you should probably just play Tireless Tracker instead. And like, this might be the one case where I expect to have lands in the graveyard, but even then, like, he's just... The Excavator is kind of a letdown. It's just really slow. If you want lands back, you might consider Renin 6. I mean, that's a cheaper way to do it. That's red, of course, but...
Now, the other way I thought was thinking you could build this deck is you could even make it like a Spirits deck. You could add blue, you could play Spellqueller if you wanted, but you could even add a sideboard plan of like Geist of St. Traft with Talawisp if you just wanted to, like, you know, do a total juke and, you know, whatever, find that blue-white enchantment for Geist and enchant it. Obviously, none of these things matter in a world where Hogak is around, but...
So, Talawisp will get you an aura out of your deck every time you cast any spirit or arcane. Is that
correct?
Right? So what kind of auras, like how many auras are you going to put in and how many Talawisps? Because that kind of requires a package of...
Yeah, that, I mean, that does get to be a lot of cards. This is something I was considering. Maybe like 3 Talawisps and one of the blue-white enchantment that makes your creature unblockable and gives it lifelink.
So are you thinking that you would actually change the entire shell into like not play green at that point? Like
You'd play a Bant list, and I would just take out the Celestial Kieran combo, basically, against decks. Like, against humans, where it's not great, I would just take that out. Then I would just try to play, like, Talawisp, turn 3, Geist of St. Traft, get that enchantment. Humans can't interact with Geist. They just make it unblockable and give it lifelink and just race them.
I think you undervalue Armageddon against humans. Their deck frequently just keeps needing to cast humans to keep getting their triggers off their champions and things like that.
I guess against me, they always just have Aether Vial, so...
Yeah. Well, you cast a Conjurate on one to blow up the Aether Vial.
Yeah, well, that's a great point.
So, like, let's try to think through, like, what is the value of playing additional spirits at different spots on the curve? If they're slightly underpowered, does that mean they're just going to win more? Like, Selfless Spirit is a sort of playable card. You could throw that in and be like, well, maybe I'll draw this at a useful spot or something where I want to destroy two CMC. Or do we just think that's not going to happen?
Well, you can cast Conjurant for two. I would play an extra Ranger Captain of Eos to just have more Conjurants in my hand at that point, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, one thing to mention is that Celestial Kieran, first off, is a 4-mana card you have to play first before getting this EE on 2. And second off, it's not a May, it just happens. And so if you have a Celestial Kieran and some, like, a Critical Thalia holding them back, and you draw your Selfless Spirit, you have an interesting choice to make.
Well, the only solution is to play more Selfless Spirits to protect your Thalia from your own Selfless Spirits.
That's true. Yeah, my intuition is that adding more spirits to just go off Celestial Kieran is not the right way to go. The core of a green-white value deck that can randomly either get some nice EE action or an Armageddon action. I'm not convinced Armageddon is like the best spell to be casting, especially a build-your-own Armageddon. But and the nice thing about green-white is it's the only color combo that gets to play the Horizon Canopy land. So, oh wait, just kidding.
I just think it's the one of the weaknesses. So when I try to like staple a new combo into an old deck, I'm always trying to like address a weakness that it had. And one of the weaknesses of green white is it has a slow closing speed, right? It doesn't kill very fast. That's why people are playing like Devoted Druid combo. So it's like, all right, we're accruing this value with these various green tutor cards and Collected Company, but we also have a kind of an oops I win. This is not an oops I win, but it is a way to basically delay the opponent several turns. You know, if they have 3 mana in play, I mean, it's going to be a long time before some of these modern decks can recover. Obviously, some decks can recover quite quickly. Blue Red Phoenix does not need a lot of land in play to do its thing. But that gives you time to start attacking with your, you know, now 6/6/7/7 Knight of the Reliquary.
You're tricking me into playing green white again. I knew it.
Yeah.
You're almost making me believe.
It's too easy.
So I looked to see if anyone had actually played this. I think it did show up in 150 dump, the Kieran Conjurant combo, and that deck was not playing Thalia. And I was wondering, like, if they just didn't think it was worth it in the meta, or if they were worried that it interfered with, like, the Vivians or whatever spells they're playing. Are you concerned about that? Like, or is that just like, is a 3-of Thalia, 3-of Vivian, you're not concerned about it?
Yeah, I'm not concerned about it. I mean, I think Thalia is insane. I don't know, I did not see this list that you're talking about, but I think Thalia is just great, just generally. And she's even more great if you've Wrath of Godded, so they can't, like, if they draw an island, Serum Visions to find their second land.
We've been over this. Armageddon, not Wrath of God.
Okay, now I'm wondering, like, what do you think of the card Unsettled Mariner, which is the blue-white 2/2 changeling that kind of provides a Kira-like protection effect for all of your creatures and permanents?
Yeah, I don't hate that card.
It is a spirit.
Yes.
Whether that's good or bad is unclear. You could play that. You could play this Teferi that I'm talking about. Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe that's not worth it. Like, I think that is actually... It's more generally useful than Selfless Spirit as a way to like add more incidental spirits to the deck, which we're not sure if that's good or not.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to play like this list and just see is the combo itself relatively easy to assemble? Is it powerful enough once it does its thing? And then once I got to that point, I have to decide if I need more incidental spirits. I'm not convinced that is a thing that I'd want to be doing, but...
Okay. How about Giver of Ruins, since we do kind of want to protect some of these creatures?
Yeah, +1 on Giver. Giver looks good in this list.
Yeah, plus it's searchable, so I mean, that does definitely seem like a card that we should consider adding.
And then, do we need all 8? I guess we probably do in an Armageddon deck, all 8 mana creatures.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I wanted to cut something, it'd probably be a Voice of Resurgence, or one of the Vivians. Yeah.
Oh, I definitely would want to cut a Voice of Resurgence. I just don't love that card that much.
Yeah, replace one voice with Mother Runes reprint, and cut a Vivian and play a fourth Ranger captain of Eos. I think that's probably what I'd where I'd settle down for the first test run.
Second Tracker, to be honest, too.
Dan hates Tracker, though, so it's going to be a tough sell.
I like him in green-white. I don't like him in black-green. But green-white has too much mana because of this mana dork problem. I think that any hand that doesn't have a mana dork is going to be below par for the format, but like you can't really put so many in your deck. Like I think some green-white lists only play 7, and I've seen some that only play 6, which seems crazy to me. I think if I'm going to play green-white, I'm just going to play the full 8 birds in Hierarch and just hope to make my card advantage back somewhere else. Ranger Captain helps us do that. So it is, I think this is a great home for the Ranger Captain. Like the curve just makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Dork and the Ranger Captain into Kieran. Landwrath them. what are we calling this now?
Armageddon. That's legal in Modern. Kids know what that is.
Well, you can play indestructible lands if you want. You can play Darksteel Citadels, Cascading Cataracts. You can go fully in on the combo. They'll be so impressed.
Yeah. Armageddon is one of those weird cards where, like, casting it early is not always that good. They play more lands if you cast it later. So, like, Turbo Armageddon is not always as good as it sounds.
True. I mean, we do have a Knight of the Reliquary to get buffed up by our Armageddon.
Yeah, there is an Armageddon deck in Modern. It's that Restore Balance deck. It usually ends the game. But, that doesn't happen that soon, so...
Well, the Restore Balance means that they lose their lands and their hand, right?
Technically, yes, but I mean that's not the relevant part of the card. It's the losing lands.
What? I always thought it was both.
Well, yeah, when you're playing Canlander or some format you can cast actual balance, then yes, that's an issue. But I think that in Modern, it's mostly about destroying lands and creatures too, and then having a greater guard on left over. In any case, so I think we're all sort of in agreement that this shell makes sense as a thing you can do that is probably improved by the Ranger Captain. And I guess we didn't really settle any additional cards we wanted to sneak in there. We didn't like the Illyrian Emery's Call. Was that maybe I kind of like it, but it competes with things like Vivian and is awkward with Thalia. And we didn't like the Unsettled Mariner.
I just think that adding blue is a big stretch with the color requirements of this deck. It means that you can't play as many value lands.
True. Here I do like the cavern in this deck. A searchable cavern for the Knight of the Reliquary makes a lot of sense to me.
Yes.
But yeah, this looks sweet. I'm excited to try it.
Yeah, same. Looks like it drives a lot of value. I'm really curious to see how the Celestial Kieran Conjurant combo comes up, how good it is.
And playing white gives us access to a lot of sideboard cards that are very important in the Modern metagame for various reasons, but...
Yeah, you toss, right? Four sideboard is 4 rips, we're off running for the other 11 cards.
Right. So, yeah, I know that that's kind of like an afterthought. Often we don't post sideboards with our sketches. Like, we don't even post on mana base sometimes. We're like, well, here's what we think the deck should do. But then, like, the actual games often come down heavily to sideboards. And like the 4 rest in peace, I don't think that is a great plan for this deck. It shuts off your Voice of Resurgence, it shuts off your Knight of the Reliquary, and it's also like you're not gonna kill them super fast. So I'm wondering if there's like some other plan we can come up with for sideboarding with this deck.
Well, Voice of Resurgence is not staying in the game against any deck that rest in peace is coming in for, so.
So that's a straight swap. Okay.
I think we want to keep Knight because we can still fetch Bajuka Bog, so...
Yeah, that's a great point. One Bajuka Bog main deck, maybe.
In the mana base I have sketched out, I have a Bajuka Bog main. Like, you just eat all the games, it's not good. And if you turn 2 Knight, turn 3 Bajuka Bog, you probably still lose, but at least you got to, you know, interact with your opponent briefly.
Yeah, I mean, there are games where you'll turn 2 Bajuka Bog just drawing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Dan, you could also play Leyland of the Void. I mean, generally, my understanding is that if your deck can cast Rest in Peace, it's usually better. If you're a black deck that can cast Leyland, it's better to play Leylands. But I'm not totally sure on like the theory behind these decisions.
Yeah, this may be leading us off track, but as I was thinking about like what to take away from those Abzan Splash Shape in your decks that I was tooling around with, it seemed like you can build an interesting sideboard with a diversity of hate bears. Now that Collector Oof, a strong option in the format. And now that Neoform is like cheap enough, whereas Eldritch Evolution was never quite cheap enough to like do this role, where you'd see like a green white deck that had two Eldritch Evolutions in the sideboard plus a bunch of random hate bears. And that plan was just like never very good, mostly because Eldritch Evolution is cost you a lot to cast, whereas Neoform is a little more affordable and you can convert a mana dork into a strong hate bear on two. So like, I know I keep promoting splashes, but I do think that's something to consider. Like, high value bears include the Collector Oof, Anafenza if we splash black. Lavinia is actually getting better and better. She does counter Hogak, which is helpful, and she's good against Tron, which is tends to be a bad matchup, although maybe this deck solves Tron differently with the Armageddon. There's like stuff that I kind of want to have access to in the sideboard that can help what is historically an underpowered creature-based strategy in Modern. And maybe that's not the problem this deck is going to have, but it's something I'm kicking around in my head.
I agree with that. The main problem I have is they've not yet printed a very good 2-mana bear against graveyard decks.
No, it's Yixlid Jailer or Bust. Or, I mean, they're scavenging.
I mean, and like
that
one white 4/4 guy with a cumulative upkeep put two cards underneath their library from the graveyard is just not good enough. I mean,
oh, he's interesting. The Jotun, I don't know how you pronounce that.
Yeah, Jotun Grunt. I don't know how you pronounce it either.
It's a Euro Dan.
The North American vocal cords cannot produce that sound, I assume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, Grunt is just so slow. So you play it, nothing happens, a turn it comes into play. Then next turn, you get to put two cards underneath their library. I mean,
yeah, there's Remorseful Cleric, but like you wouldn't want a tutor for that because that's a one-shot effect. Like,
yeah. And it is a spirit.
That's true. We'll kill the two drops and the graveyards. Get the altar and their graveyard at the same time. Take that.
But I guess my hope is when we test both of these decks, we can play against what I would consider to be like real modern decks in the sense that they're decks that we would expect to play in the weeks and months from now and not just keep playing against Hordak decks, which are literally just did you draw your sideboard hate or not. I mean, they don't interact in like terms of magic. There's not any magic being played. So I don't want to like tweak out our sideboard to only interact with that, and then we don't really know if our main deck is functional because we didn't get to do anything with it. And that might be the case. I mean, you can only play the decks that they match you up with. So,
I mean, yeah, the point that we only play is Hogak lists, which Modern may become in a matter of days or weeks. Then we'll have a little bit of trouble testing Brews out.
Yes. But we'll see.
But I mean, hopefully that doesn't happen.
I've been averaging 1.5 Hogak decks per out of 5 matches, which is, you know, that's not all the matches, right? That's still only once or twice per league. One of the great things about Modern, you can play what you want. People will play what they want. The other category is always 30 or 35% of the meta. You might not win. That's the only catch.
Right.
But you'll be learning. You'll be learning. Isn't that what it's all about?
So yeah, I think we've got some intriguing avenues to pursue. Ranger Captain of Eos. It has a lot of text on it. And I guess we're going to find out if that text is relevant in the brave new modern world we've entered.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
Well, we'll bid you gentlemen adieu until next week.
That'll do it for episode 7 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. All of the lists that we discussed on today's show are posted in the show notes. Those are the links that you'll find in the episode description. And in a post on the Modern subreddit at r/modernmagic. You can find us there and let us know what you thought of today's decks. I try my best to respond. We love to brew and we would love to hear from you. If you liked what you heard on today's show, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. That would really help us out. We are a young podcast and we are doing our best to spread the word, so every little thing like that really helps. So come say hello, give us your feedback, give us a follow, and we will see you next week.